I didn't lose my temper. I don't know why Dr. Moon would think that. I don't know why my mother didn't stand up and object. I don't know why Oliver isn't telling the truth. I used to have nightmares where the sun was coming too close to the earth, and I was the only one who knew it, because my skin could sense a change in temperature more accurately than anyone else's. No matter what I did to try to warn people, nobody ever listened to me. And eventually, trees started to burst into flame, and my family was burned alive. I would wake up and see the sunrise, and I'd freak out all over again, because how could I really be sure that my nightmare had been a nightmare after all, and not actually a premonition? I think the same thing is happening now. After years of imagining I'm an alien in this world, with senses more acute than those of normal people, and with speech patterns that don't make sense to normal people, and behaviors that look odd on this planet but that, on my home planet, must be perfectly acceptable, it has actually become true. Truth is a lie, and lies are the truth. The members of the jury believe what they hear, not what's right in front of their eyes. And no one is listening, no matter how loud I'm screaming inside my own head.
Emma. The space beneath the blanket feels like it has a heartbeat. In the dark, I find Jacob's hand and I squeeze it. Honey, I say, we have to go. He turns to me. In the blackness, I can see the reflection of his eyes. I didn't lose my temper with Jess, he mutters. We can talk about that later. I didn't hurt her, Jacob says. I stop and stare at him. I want to believe him. God, I want to believe him. But then I imagine that quilt I sewed for him, wrapped around the body of a dead girl. I didn't mean to hurt her, Jacob corrects. Nobody looks into the face of a newborn son and imagines all the things that will go wrong in his life. Instead, you see nothing but possibility. His first smile, his first steps, his graduation, his wedding dance, his face when he's holding his own baby. With Jacob, I was constantly revising the milestones. When he willingly looks me in the eye. When he can accept a change in plans without falling apart. When he wears a shirt without meticulously cutting out the tag in the back. You don't love a child for what he does or doesn't do. You love him for who he is. And even if he is a murderer, by design or by accident, he is still mine. Not connecting with his peers, Helen Sharp says. Being the center of his own universe. Self-preservation is the one inviolable rule. Temper tantrums and anger management issues. Sounds to me, Dr. Murano, like Asperger's is the new selfish. No? It's not an unwillingness to consider someone else's feelings. It's an inability to do it. Yet this is a relatively new diagnosis, isn't it? It first appeared in the DSM-IV manual in 1994, but it wasn't new by any means. There were plenty of people with Asperger's prior to that who simply weren't labeled. Such as Steven Spielberg, the director. John Elder Robison, the author. Satoshi Tajiri, who created the Pokemon phenomenon. Peter Tork of the band The Monkees. They were all diagnosed formally with Asperger's as adults. And they are all extremely successful, aren't they? Helen asks. It seems that way. They've led very productive lives interacting with other people. I assume so. Do you think any of them have trouble relating to others socially? Yes, I do.
Do you think any of them might have experienced a moment where they were picked on or felt marginalized?
I don't know, Ms. Sharp.
Really? Have you seen Peter Tork's old haircut? I'll go out on a limb and say yes, they have been teased. And yet, none of these men with Asperger's is on trial for murder, are they?
No. Like I said, there isn't a casual link between Asperger's and violence.
If Asperger's doesn't make someone violent, how can it be an excuse for someone like Jacob committing a horrific act of violence? Objection, Oliver says. That's prejudicial. Sustained, the judge replies.
The prosecutor shrugs.
Withdrawn. Dr. Murano, how did you formalize your diagnosis of Jacob's Asperger's?
I administered an IQ test and an assessment of adaptive skills to see how Jacob would handle certain social situations. I did interviews with Emma Hunt and with his teachers to get a sense of Jacob's history of behavior. Asperger's doesn't show up overnight. I saw videotapes of him prior to age 2, when he was still meeting developmental milestones for neurotypical children, and then the subsequent decline in behavior and interpersonal connections. And I observed him during a number of sessions both in my office and at his school in social settings.
There's no blood test or any other scientific test that can be administered to see if a child has Asperger's, is there?
No. It's based primarily on observation of repetitive behavior and interests and a lack of social interaction that impairs everyday functioning without a significant delay in language.
So, it's a judgment call?
Yes, Dr. Murano says. An educated one.
If Jacob had seen another psychiatrist, isn't it possible he or she might have determined that Jacob doesn't have Asperger's?
I highly doubt it. The diagnosis most often confused with Asperger's is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And when they put Aspie kids on ADHD medicine and they don't respond, it's often clear that the diagnosis needs to be revisited.
So the criteria you used to diagnose Jacob were his inability to communicate with other people, his trouble reading social cues, his desire for routine and structure, and his fixation on certain topics?
Yes, that's about right, the psychiatrist says.
Say I have a 7-year-old who's completely obsessed with Power Rangers and who has to have his cookie and milk every night before bedtime, who isn't very good about telling me what happens in school every day or sharing his toys with his younger brother. Does my 7-year-old have Asperger's?
Not necessarily. Let's say you have 2 3-year-olds in the sandbox. One says, "Look at my truck." The other responds, "I have a doll." That's parallel play, and it's normal at that age. But if you study those same 2 children at age 8, and one says, "Look at my truck," the appropriate response is something like, "That's a cool truck," or "Can I touch it?" or some other sentence that continues the interaction with the child who made the conversational overture. However, a kid with Asperger's might still say, in response, "I have a doll." When the playmate walks away, the kid with Asperger's won't understand why. In his mind, he's responded to the sentence and kept the conversation going. He doesn't comprehend that what he said wasn't a valid rejoinder.
Or, Helen Sharp says, the kid with the doll might just be really self-centered, right?
With Asperger's, that's often the case.
But without Asperger's, it's occasionally the case, too. My point, Doctor, is that the diagnosis you make and the assumptions you have about Jacob are not based on anything other than your own opinion. You're not looking at a talk screen or brainwaves.
There are a variety of psychiatric disorders where clinical observation is the only method of diagnosis, Ms. Sharp. This happens to be one of them. and any psychiatrist in this country will tell you that Asperger's syndrome is a valid disorder. It may be difficult to describe to someone else in concrete terms, but when you see it, you know what it is. And just to be clear, you feel that having Asperger's syndrome affected Jacob's behavior the day Jess Ogilvie was murdered. That's right. Because Jacob couldn't handle social situations well, and he wasn't empathetic, and his frustration sometimes led to anger management problems. That's right, Dr. Murano says. Which are traits you find in someone with Asperger's? Yes. What a coincidence, the prosecutor says, folding her arms. They're also traits you find in cold-blooded killers. Once Jacob told me that he could hear plants dying. They scream, he said. I thought for certain this was ridiculous, until I talked to Dr. Murano about it. Kids with Asperger's, she said, have senses we can't even imagine. We filter out sounds and sights that are constantly barraging their brains, which is why sometimes it seems like they're off in their own little world. They're not, she said. They're in our world, but they're more engaged in it than we'll ever be. I went home that day and I looked up plant death on the internet. As it turned out, plants under stress emit ethylene gas, and scientists in Germany have created a device that measures the energy of those molecules as vibrations, or sound. Now I wonder if it gets tiring, bearing witness to the last gasp of nature. If it's not only plants my son hears, but the gnash of an angry ocean, a shy sunrise, a breaking heart.
Oliver. My high school guidance counselor, Mrs. Inverhall, once had me take an aptitude test to figure out my future. The number one job recommendation for my set of skills was an air traffic accident investigator, of which there are fewer than 50 in the world. The number two job was a museum curator for Chinese American studies. The number three job was a circus clown. I'm pretty sure lawyer wasn't even on the list. Sometime after I graduated from college, I heard through the grapevine that this same guidance counselor had taken an early retirement and moved to a utopian community in Idaho, where she renamed herself Blessing and now raises alpacas. Frances Grenville doesn't look like she's in any danger of starting a llama farm anytime soon. She's wearing a blouse buttoned to the throat, and her hands are clasped so tightly in her lap that I imagine her nails are leaving marks on the skin. Mrs. Grenville, I say, where are you employed?
At Townsend Regional High School.
And how long have you been a guidance counselor there?
This is my 10th year.
What are your responsibilities? I ask.
I help students with college search and selection. I write recommendations for students applying to college. And I work with students who face behavioral issues during their school career.
Do you know Jacob?
I do, because he has an IEP. I've been intimately involved in the organization of his school day to accommodate his special needs.
Can you explain what an IEP is?
An individualized education program, she says. It's an educational plan mandated by federal law to improve educational results for children with disabilities. Each IEP is different based on the child. For Jacob, for example, we created a list of rules to be adhered to in a school setting because he functions well with strictures and routines.
Have you met with Jacob for reasons other than his learning needs?
Yes, Mrs. Grenville says. There have been instances where he's gotten into trouble with teachers for acting out in class.
How so?
In one case, he kept telling his biology teacher that he was wrong when the teacher made certain factual statements in class.
She hesitates.
Mr. Hubbard was teaching the structure of DNA. He paired adenine with adenine instead of pairing it with thymine. When Jacob told him this was incorrect, Mr. Hubbard got angry. Jacob didn't realize the teacher was angry and kept pointing out the inaccuracy. Mr. Hubbard sent him to the principal's office for being disruptive in class. Did he explain to you why he didn't know his teacher was angry? Yes. He said that Mr. Hubbard's angry face looks a lot like other people's when they're happy. Does it? Mrs. Grenville pursed her lips. I have noticed that Mr. Hubbard has a tendency to smirk when he gets frustrated. Do you happen to know if it is incorrect to pair adenine with adenine? As it turns out, Jacob was right. I glance back at the defense table. Jacob is smiling from ear to ear. Were there any other incidents when you had to help Jacob? Last year, he got into trouble with a young woman. She was very upset over a poor grade and somehow communicated to Jacob that if he really wanted to be her friend, he'd tell the math teacher to go. She looks down at her lap. Fornicate with himself. Jacob was given detention for that and later confronted the young woman and grabbed her by the throat. Then what happened? A teacher saw him and pulled him away from the girl. Jacob was suspended for 2 weeks. He would have been expelled if not for his IEP and the understanding that he was provoked. What have you done to modify Jacob's social behavior in school? He attended social skills class, but then Emma Hunt and I discussed getting a private tutor for Jacob instead. We thought he might be able to better work on specific situations that tended to upset him so that he could deal with them more constructively. Did you find a tutor? Yes. I contacted the university and they put feelers out in their education department. She looks at the jury. Jess Ogilvie was the first student to respond to the request. Had Jacob been meeting with her? Yes, since last fall. Mrs. Grenville, since Jacob began his tutoring with Jess Ogilvie, have there been any incidents of him losing his temper? She shakes her head. Not one, she says. Your witness, I say to Helen. The prosecutor stands up. Mr. Hubbard, the biology teacher, he was angry, and Jacob didn't realize it. No. Would you say that's a problem for Jacob, knowing when someone's angry at him? From what I know about Asperger's, yes. The other incident you raised involved Jacob cursing out a teacher on a dare and then attacking the girl who dared him, correct? Yes. Had Jacob been told before to not use physical violence to solve problems? Certainly, the counselor says. He knew that was a school rule. But he broke that rule, Helen asks. He did. Even though, according to your own testimony, following rules is very important to Jacob. Even though, Mrs. Grenville says. Did he have any explanation for you as to why he broke that rule? Mrs. Grenville shakes her head slowly. He said that he just snapped. Helen considers this. You also said, Mrs. Grenville, that since starting his tutoring sessions, Jacob hasn't lost his temper in school. That's correct. Apparently he was saving that for after school, Helen says. Nothing further. Court adjourns early that day because Judge Cuttings has a doctor's appointment. As the room empties, I gather up my files and stuff them into my briefcase. So, I say to Emma, I'd like to come over and talk to you about your testimony. Out of the corner of my eye, I can see Theo and Henry making their way toward us. I thought we discussed this, Emma says pointedly. We did, but I'll be damned if I'm going back to my office while I know Henry is under her roof. You can never be too ready, I tell her. We have 2 cars. No sense in all of you being crammed into one. Would anyone like to ride with me? I am staring straight at Emma. That's a good idea, she says. Jacob, why don't you go? Which is how I wind up trailing Henry's rental car with Jacob sitting beside me in the passenger seat of the truck, and only after a small fit because he prefers to ride in the back seat and there isn't one. He fiddles with the radio, which is AM stations only, because my truck is old enough to have been built by Moses. You know why you can pick up AM stations better at night? Jacob says. Because the ionosphere reflects radio signals better when the sun isn't radiating the heck out of the upper atmosphere. Thanks, I say. I couldn't have gone to sleep tonight without knowing that. Jacob looks at me. Really? No, I'm kidding. He folds his arms. Haven't you been listening to yourself in court? I don't get sarcasm. I'm totally self-centered. Oh, and at any moment, I might just go totally crazy. You're not crazy, I tell him. I'm just trying to get the jury to see you as legally insane. Jacob slumps in his seat. I'm not a big fan of labels. What do you mean? When I first got my diagnosis, my mother was relieved because she saw it as something that would be helpful. I mean, teachers don't look at kids who are reading 8 grade levels above where they should be and doing complex mathematical proofs in 3rd grade and think they need special help, even if they are being teased all the time. The diagnosis helped me get an IEP, which was great, but it also changed things in a bad way. Jacob shrugs. I guess I expected it to be like this other girl in my grade who has a port wine stain on half her face. People go right up to her and ask about it, and she says it's a birthmark and that it doesn't hurt. End of story. No one ever asks if they can catch it like a virus or doesn't want to play with her because of it. But if you tell someone you're autistic and half the time they talk louder to you, like you might be deaf, and the few things that I used to get credit for, like being smart or having a really excellent memory, were all of a sudden just things that made me even more weird. He is quiet for a moment, and then he turns to me. I'm not autistic. I have autism. I also have brown hair and flat feet. So I don't understand why I'm always the kid with Asperger's, Jacob says. I keep my eyes on the road. Because it's better than being the kid who killed Jess Ogilvy, I reply. And after that, we don't talk at all. It figures. Henry's showed up on a day when the food is not noticeably Aspergian. Emma's made steak and baked potatoes and gravy and gluten-free brownies. If Henry notices the lack of a green vegetable, or anything on the plate that isn't brown for that matter, he doesn't mention it. So, Henry, I say, you do programming? He nods. Right now I'm parsing XML for a point-and-click web app for the iPhone that'll spice up 400 contemporary American ethnic dishes with Chinese herbs and sauces. He launches into a 15-minute discussion of esoteric computer programming that none of us can follow. Guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, I say. Actually, I work for Adobe, Henry says. Theo and I are the only ones who find that funny. I wonder if Henry's ever been diagnosed. And you're remarried, right? I look at Emma when I say this. Yes, I've got 2 girls, he says, and then hurries to add, in addition to the 2 boys, of course. Of course, I answer, and I break a brownie in half. So, when are you leaving? Oliver, Emma says. Henry laughs. Well, I guess that depends on how long the trial goes on. He leans back in his chair. Emma, that was a great dinner. Just wait till Blue Friday, I muse. I'd better go find myself a hotel, since I've been up for about 36 straight hours, and I'm bound to crash and burn soon, Henry says. You'll stay here, Emma announces, and both Henry and I look at her, surprised. Well, it's silly to have you stay a half hour away when we're all going to the same place tomorrow morning, isn't it? Theo, your father can sleep in your room, and you can have the couch. What? Theo yelps. Why do I have to give up my room? What about Jacob? Let me put it this way, Emma answers. Do you want to sleep on the couch, or do you want to help me when Jacob has a meltdown? He shoves away from the table, angry. Where are the extra freaking pillows? I don't want to put anyone out, Henry says. Emma, I interrupt, can I have a few minutes? Oh, right. You wanted to go over testimony? She turns to Jacob. Honey, can you clear the table and load the dishwasher? He stands up and starts clearing as I drag Emma upstairs. We need to go somewhere quiet, I say, and I lead her into her own bedroom. I've never been in here. It's peaceful, all cool greens and sea blues. There's a Zen garden on the dresser with a rake and three black stones. In the sand, someone has written H-E-L-P. The only part I'm still nervous about is the cross exam, Emma says, all she can manage to get out before I grab her and kiss her. It's not gentle, either. It's the physical equivalent of pouring into her all the feelings I can't put into words. When she breaks away from me, her mouth is rosy and swollen, and that makes me take a step toward her again. But she puts her hand on my chest to hold me off. Oh my God, she says with a slow smile. You're jealous. Well, what the hell was that all about? It's silly to have you stay a half hour away. It is. He's the boy's father, not some stranger who just came in off the street. So, he's going to be sleeping right on the other side of this wall? Sleeping would be the operative word in that sentence, Emma says. He's here for Jacob. Believe me, there's no ulterior motive for Henry. But you used to love him. Her eyebrows shoot up. Do you think I've been sitting here for 15 years pining for him? Waiting for the moment he would walk through that door again so I could hide him in a bedroom upstairs and seduce him? No, I tell her, but I wouldn't put it past him. She stares at me for a moment, and then she bursts out laughing. You haven't seen his perfect little wife and his perfect little girls. Believe me, Oliver, I'm not the great love of his life, the one he'll never forget. You are to me, I say. The smile fades from her face, and then she rises up on her toes and kisses me back. Don't you need this? At the sound of Jacob's voice, we jump apart, putting a few feet of space between us. He stands in the doorway, one hand still on the knob, and the other one holding my legal briefcase. Were you just... He stumbles over his words. Are you two... Without saying anything else, he throws my briefcase hard at me, so forcefully that I grunt when I catch it. He runs down the hallway into his room and slams the door.
What did he see?
Emma asks frantically.
When did he walk in?
Suddenly, Henry is standing in the doorway, looking quizzically down the hall where Jacob's gone, and then at Emma.
Everything all right up here?
Emma faces me.
I think maybe you ought to go home, she says.
Emma. When I walk into Jacob's room, he's hunched over his desk, humming Marley, and writing furiously across his green blotter. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89, 144, 233. I take the pencil out of his hand, and he turns in his swivel chair.
Do I make you horny, baby?
He says, bitter. No movie quotes, I tell Jacob. Especially not Austin Powers. I know you're upset.
Let me think about that. My mother is supposed to be practicing her testimony with my lawyer, and instead she has her tongue halfway down his throat? Yeah, that might make me a little upset.
I tamp down the flash of anger that rises inside me. First of all, I'm completely ready to testify. And second of all, I didn't expect to kiss him, it just happened.
Things like that don't just happen, Jacob argues. You want them to happen or you don't.
Well, all right then. I suppose after 15 years of being alone, I don't mind being attractive to someone.
Not someone, he says. My lawyer.
He's completely focused on your trial, Jacob.
I don't care about him. I mean, if he isn't doing his job, I can just fire him. But you,
he yells.
How could you do this to me right now? You're my mother.
I stand up, toe to toe with him. One who's given up her whole life to take care of you, I say. One who loves you so much she would trade places with you in a heartbeat, but that doesn't mean I don't deserve to be happy too.
Well, I hope you're really happy when I lose this trial because you were too busy being a slut.
And just like that, I slap him. I don't know which one of us is more surprised. I've never struck Jacob in my life. He holds his palm to his cheek as the red print of my hand rises on his skin. I'm sorry. Oh, God, Jacob, I'm sorry, I say, the words somersaulting over each other. I pull his hand down so that I can see the damage I've done. I'll get you some ice, I say. But he's staring at me as if he's never seen me before. So instead of leaving, I sit him down on the bed and I pull him against me, the way I used to when he was little and the world became too much for him to bear. I rock, so that he doesn't have to. Slowly, he relaxes against me. Jacob, I tell him, I didn't mean to hurt you. It's only after he nods that I realize I've repeated the very same words Jacob said earlier to me about Jess Ogilvie. In all the years that Jacob has had tantrums and meltdowns and panic attacks, I've restrained him, sat on him, held him like a vice, but I have never hit him. I know the unwritten strictures. Good parents don't spank. Reward works better than punishment. Yet it only took a single moment of frustration, of realizing that I couldn't simultaneously be whom he needed me to be and whom I wanted to be, for me to snap. Is that what happened to Jacob, too? Oliver has called 4 times tonight, but I didn't pick up the phone when I recognized the number on the caller ID. Maybe this is my penance. Maybe I just don't know what to say. It's just after 2 in the morning when my bedroom door opens a crack. I sit up immediately, expecting Jacob. But instead, Henry enters. He's wearing pajama bottoms and a t-shirt that reads, "There's no place like 127.0.0.1. I saw your light on, he says. Can't sleep? Henry shakes his head. You? No. He gestures to the edge of the bed. May I? I shift over. He sits down on my side of the bed, but I see him staring at the pillow beside me. I know, I say. It must seem a little weird. No, it's just that now I sleep on the left side of the bed like you, and I'm wondering how that happened. I lean back against the headboard. There are lots of things I don't have the answers for. I don't know exactly what all the yelling was about, Henry says delicately. But I did hear it. Yeah, we've had better nights. I owe you an apology, Emma, he says. First of all, for showing up like this. I should have asked, at least. You've got enough on your plate without having to deal with me. I guess I was really only thinking of myself. Luckily, I have a lot of practice with that. That's the other thing I have to apologize for, Henry says. I should have been here all the other nights there was yelling or tantrums or anything else that was part of raising Jacob. I probably learned more about him today in that courtroom than I've known in the 18 years he's been alive. I should have been here to help during all the bad times. I smile a little. I guess that's the difference between us. I wish you'd been here for the good times. I look over his shoulder into the hallway. Jacob is sweet and funny and so smart he leaves me reeling sometimes, and I'm sorry you never got to know that part of him. He reaches across the quilt and squeezes my hand. You're a good mom, Emma, he says, and I have to look away, because that makes me think of my argument with Jacob, Then Henry speaks again.
Did he do it?
I turn to him slowly. Does it matter? I can only remember one concrete instance when I blew up at Jacob before. It was when he was 12 and hadn't acknowledged the fact that it was my birthday, with a card or a gift or even a hug, although I had dropped enough hints in the weeks prior. So one evening, when I made dinner, I slapped it on the table in front of him with more force than usual and waited in vain, like always, for Jacob to thank me.
How about a little gratitude? I exploded. How about some recognition that I've done something for you?
Confused, Jacob glanced at his plate and then at me. I make your dinner, I fold your laundry, I drive you to school and back. Did you ever wonder why I do that?
Because it's your job?
No, it's because I love you. And when you love someone, you do things for them without complaining about it.
But you are complaining, he said.
That was when I realized Jacob would never understand love. He would have bought me a birthday gift if I'd told him explicitly to do so, but that wouldn't really have been a gift from the heart. You can't make someone love you. It has to come from inside him, and Jacob wasn't wired that way. I remember storming out of the kitchen and sitting on the porch for a while, under the light of the moon, which isn't really light at all, just a pale reflection of the sun.
Oliver. Jacob, I say as soon as I see him the next morning, we need to talk. I fall into step beside him as we move across the parking lot, putting enough space between us and his family to ensure privacy. Did you know there's not really a term for a man whore? Jacob asks. I mean, there's gigolo, but that suggests money was exchanged. All right, look, I sigh. I'm sorry you walked in on us, but I'm not going to apologize for liking her. I could fire you, Jacob says. You could try, but it's up to the judge since we're in the middle of the trial. What if he found out about your misconduct with clients? She's not my client, I say. You are. And if anything, my feelings for your mother only make me more determined to win this case. He hesitates. I'm not talking to you anymore, Jacob mutters, and he increases his speed until he is nearly sprinting up the steps of the courthouse. Ava Newcomb, the forensic shrink hired by the defense, is the linchpin of my case. If she cannot make the jury understand that some of the traits associated with Asperger's might have caused Jacob to kill Jess Ogilvie without really understanding why that was wrong, then Jacob will be convicted. Dr. Newcomb, what's the legal definition of insanity? She is tall, poised, and professional, right out of central casting. So far, I think, so good. It states that at the time an act was committed, the defendant was not able to know right from wrong due to a severe mental defect or illness. Can you give us an example of a mental defect or illness that qualifies? Something that suggests psychotic breaks from reality, like schizophrenia, she says. Is that the only kind of mental defect that constitutes legal insanity? No. Does Asperger's syndrome cause someone to have psychotic breaks? No. But there are other symptoms of Asperger's that might prevent someone from distinguishing right from wrong at a particular moment in time. Such as, the intense fixation on a subject that someone with Asperger's has can be overwhelming and obsessive, to the point where it impedes function in daily activities, or even crosses the boundary of the law. I once had a patient who was so focused on horses that he continually was arrested for breaking into a local stable. Jacob's current special interest is forensic analysis and crime scene investigation. It was evident in my interview with him, as well as in his obsession with the television show Crime Busters and the detailed journals he kept about each episode's plot. How might a fixation like that contribute to some of the evidence we've heard in this courtroom? I ask. We have heard that Jacob was increasingly popping up at crime scenes, thanks to his police scanner,
the psychiatrist says. And Jess Ogilvie's death was part of an elaborate crime scene. The evidence was arranged to look at first glance like a kidnapping, then eventually revealed the victim. It is possible that the opportunity to create a crime scene, instead of just observing fictional ones, led Jacob to act in a way that went against rules, laws, and morality. At the time, he would only have been thinking about the fact that he was creating a real crime scene that would be solved by law enforcement officials. In this way, an Aspergian fixation on forensic analysis led Jacob to the delusional belief that, at that moment, Jess's death was a necessary part of his study of forensic science. As chilling as it seems to us, the victim becomes collateral damage during the pursuit of a greater goal. But didn't Jacob know that murder is illegal? Absolutely. He is the poster child for following rules, for seeing things as either right or wrong with no mitigating circumstances. However, Jacob's actions wouldn't have been voluntary at that moment. He had no understanding of the nature and consequences of his actions, and he couldn't have stopped if he wanted to. I frowned slightly. But we've also heard that Jess Ogilvie and Jacob were extremely close. Surely that would have affected him. Actually, that's another reason we can conclude that Asperger's played a role in what happened to Jess. People with Asperger's have a greatly impaired theory of mind. They can't put themselves into someone else's position to imagine what the other person might be thinking or feeling. To the layperson, it's a lack of empathy. So, for example, if Jess were crying, Jacob wouldn't try to comfort her. He might know that people with tears in their eyes are usually sad, but he'd be making a cognitive judgment, not an emotional one. For someone with Asperger's, this lack of empathy is a neurobiological deficit, and it affects behavior. In Jacob's case, it would have lessened his ability to perceive the impact of his own actions on Jess. But still, doctor, I say, playing devil's advocate, there's a big difference between not handing someone a hanky when she's crying and killing her so that she can be a pawn in a crime scene setup. Of course there is, the psychiatrist turns to the jury. And this is probably the hardest thing for the layperson to understand. We're always looking for motive in a crime that's as horrific as this one is. I've considered this from my discussions with Jacob and with Dr. Morano, and I think the answer lies in the argument Jess and Jacob had the Sunday before her death. The calling card for Asperger's is impaired social interaction. To that end, someone with Asperger's has a very naive and limited understanding of relationships, which might lead him to seek contact in an inappropriate way. This leads to disappointment, and even anger if a relationship doesn't work out the way he's anticipated. She looks at Jacob. I don't know what was said between Jacob and Jess the afternoon of her death, but I believe Jacob had a crush on his tutor. Ironically, his rigid sense of right and wrong, which you'd think would deter criminal behavior, might actually have backfired here. If Jess rebuffed Jacob's advances, he would have felt that she'd done something wrong to him, that he was the victim. And then what? I ask. He snapped. He lashed out without realizing what he was physically doing at the time he did it. Nothing further, I say, and I sit down. I glance at Jacob, who is glaring at me. Emma stares straight ahead. She seems determined to not acknowledge my existence today. Helen Sharp stands up. There are a lot of kids who've been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, so are you telling us that the world's full of ticking time bombs? That at any moment, if we look at one of those kids the wrong way, he might come after us with a carving knife? No. In fact, it's the opposite. People with Asperger's aren't prone to violence. Since they don't have an active theory of mind, they aren't motivated to hurt someone. In fact, they're not thinking about that person's feelings at all. If someone with Asperger's does become violent, it's during the single-minded pursuit of a special interest, during a state of panic, or during a moment of complete ignorance about appropriate social interaction. Isn't it true, Doctor, that most defendants who claim insanity do so because of a psychotic break from reality? Yes. But Asperger's isn't a psychotic disorder, Helen says. No, it would fall more in line with personality disorders, which are characterized by perceptual and interpersonal distortions. In legal terms, doesn't the absence of psychotic episodes suggest that the person is personally and criminally responsible for his or her actions? The psychiatrist shifts. Yes, but there might be a loophole for Asperger's. We can't scientifically prove that someone with Asperger's has a very different experience of subjective reality than someone who doesn't have Asperger's, and yet the extreme sensitivity to light and sound and taste and touch and texture indicate that this is the case. If that could be measured, there would be strong parallels between Asperger's and psychosis. There is a sharp jab in my side as Jacob elbows me. He passes me a blank piece of paper. If that were true, Helen says, wouldn't this suggest that someone with Asperger's has a hard time being aware of reality and his role in it? Exactly, which is why it might very well contribute to legal insanity, Ms. Sharp. But didn't you also say that Jacob's fixation on forensics led him to use Jess Ogilvie's death to create his own crime scene? Yes. And wouldn't such premeditation and careful calculation suggest he knew very well what he was doing at the moment? Dr. Newcomb shrugs. It's a theory, she says. You also mentioned a lack of empathy, Helen approaches the witness stand. You said it's one of the features of Asperger's syndrome? That's right. Would you consider that an emotional measure or a cognitive one? Emotional? Is lack of empathy part of the test for legal insanity, Doctor? No. Isn't it true that the determination for legal insanity is whether the defendant knew right from wrong at the time the act was committed? Yes. Is that an emotional measure or a cognitive one? A cognitive one. So lack of empathy simply means someone is cold, heartless, without remorse, Helen says. But it doesn't necessarily mean he's unaware of the nature and consequence of his actions. They often go hand in hand, Dr. Newcomb says. Do they? Helen asks. A mafia hitman has no empathy when he offs his victims, but that doesn't make him legally insane, just psychopathic. Jacob elbows me again, but I am already getting to my feet. Objection, I say. Is there a question buried under Ms. Sharp's grandstanding? If I may, Dr. Newcomb says, turning to the judge for permission. Ms. Sharp seems to be trying to draw a hard parallel between someone with Asperger's and a psychopath. However, people with Asperger's don't demonstrate the superficial charm that psychopaths do, nor do they try to manipulate others. They don't have enough interpersonal skills to do it well, frankly, and that usually makes them the prey for psychopaths rather than the predators. And yet, Helen qualifies, Jacob has a history of aggression, doesn't he? Not to my knowledge. Did he, or did he not, have an argument with Jess 2 days before her death, one that was overheard by employees of Mama S's pizzeria? Well, yes, but that wasn't a physical assault. Okay, what about the fact that he was given detention last year for trying to strangle a classmate? A flurry of blank notes land in front of me, and again, I sweep them aside. Just hang on, I say through my teeth to Jacob, and then I signal to the judge. Objection? I'll rephrase. Did you know that Jacob was given detention for physically assaulting a girl in his grade? Yes, I remember Dr. Morano mentioning that to me. Yet it seems the trigger was the same, an interpersonal relationship that didn't quite match Jacob's intentions. He felt humiliated and he snapped, the prosecutor interrupts. Right? Right. And that's why Jess Ogilvie was killed. In my opinion, yes. Tell me this, doctor, Helen says. Had Jacob still snapped when he was alphabetizing the CD collection in her residence after her death? Yes. How about when he moved Jess's body 300 yards to a culvert behind the house? Yes. Had he still snapped when he sat her upright and carefully covered her with his quilt and set her hands in her lap? Dr. Newcomb jerks her chin the slightest bit. And had he still snapped days later when he went back to visit Jess's body and phoned 911 so that the police would find her? Well, the psychiatrist says quietly. I guess so. Then tell me, doctor, Helen Sharp asks. When did Jacob snap out of it?
Emma. They're lying, Jacob says heatedly, as soon as we're alone. They're all lying. I've been watching him grow more tightly wound with each passing minute of the forensic psychiatrist's cross-examination. Even though Jacob passed multiple notes to Oliver, he didn't ask for a break until Helen Sharp finished going for the kill. I didn't know what would happen, to be honest. If he would refuse to let me join him for the recess, if he'd still be holding a grudge from last night's episode. But apparently, I am the lesser of the two evils at the defense table, which is why I'm granted admission to the sensory break room, and Oliver is not. We talked about this, Jacob, I say. Remember how saying you're legally insane doesn't mean anything? It just gives the jury something to use to find you not guilty. It's a tool, like telling the school district you have Asperger's. That didn't change who you were. It only made it easier for teachers to understand your learning style. I don't care about the defense, Jacob argues. I care about what those people are saying I did. You know how the law works. The burden of proof is on the prosecution. If Oliver can find witnesses who will weave another scenario about what could have happened, the jury might find reasonable doubt, and then they can't convict. I reach for Jacob's hand. It's like giving someone a book, baby, and saying there might be more than one ending. But I didn't want her to die, Mom. It wasn't my fault. I know it was an accident. Jacob's eyes are full of tears. I miss her. My breath freezes in my throat. Oh, Jacob, I whisper. What did you do? The right thing. So why can't we tell the jury that? I want to block out his words because I'm about to testify. And that means I cannot lie if the prosecutor asks what Jacob's told me about Jess's death. I want to run until all I can hear is the rush of my blood instead of his confession. Because, I say softly, sometimes the hardest thing to hear is the truth.
This ends Disc 16. House Rules, Disc 17.
Oliver, here's what I know. Before we took that last sensory break, Jacob was a jittery, wild mess. Now that we're back in session, Emma's on the witness stand, and she's a jittery, wild mess. After I lead her through the basics of her identity and her relationship to Jacob, I walk up to the witness box and pretend to fumble and drop my pen. As I bend down, I whisper to her, "Just breathe." What the hell could have happened in the 15 minutes they were gone? What do you do for a living, Ms. Hunt? She doesn't answer, just stares into her lap. Ms. Hunt? Emma's head jerks up. Can you repeat the question? Focus, sweetheart, I think. Your job? What do you do? I used to write an advice column, she says quietly. I was asked to take a leave of absence after Jacob's arrest.
How did you get into that business?
Desperation. I was a single parent with a newborn and a 3-year-old who'd suddenly developed autistic behaviors.
As she speaks, her voice gets stronger and picks up steam.
There were therapists in and out of my house all day long who were trying to keep Jacob from completely slipping away from me. I had to find work, but I couldn't leave the house.
How did Jacob's diagnosis come about?
He was a perfectly healthy, happy baby,
Emma says, and she looks at Jacob. For a moment, she can't speak, and she shakes her head.
We gave him his shots, and within a week, this very loving, interactive, verbal boy stopped being the child I knew. Suddenly, he was lying on his side, spinning the wheels of his toy trucks instead of zooming them around the living room.
What did you do?
Everything, Emma says. I put Jacob through applied behavior analysis, occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy. I put him on a gluten-free, casein-free diet. I gave him a regimen of vitamins and supplements that had been successful for other parents of autistic kids.
Did it work?
To some extent. Jacob got to the point where he wasn't isolating himself. He could function in the world with limitations. Eventually, his diagnosis changed from a generic autism spectrum disorder to pervasive developmental disorder to, finally, Asperger's.
Is there a silver lining to that diagnosis?
Yes, Emma says. Jacob has an amazing, dry sense of humor. He's the smartest person I know. And if I want someone to keep me company when I'm running errands or unloading the dishwasher or just taking a walk, he's quick to volunteer. He'll do anything I ask him to. And he'll also not do something if I ask. I'm probably the only mother who's never had to worry about her son doing drugs or drinking underage.
But there must be times that it's hard for you as a parent.
All the things I listed that make Jacob a perfect kid, well, that's what makes him different from the average kid. All his life, Jacob's wanted to fit in with his peers, and all his life I've watched him be teased or turned down. You can't imagine what it's like to force a smile when your son wins a medal at his peewee t-ball team banquet for getting hit by the most pitches. You have to close your eyes when you drop him off at school and he gets out of the car wearing a big pair of headphones to help block out the noise of the busy hallways. And then as he walks away, you see other kids teasing him behind his back.
If I were to come to your house on a Tuesday, I say, what would I notice?
The food. If it's Tuesday, all the food has to be red. Raspberries and strawberries and tomato soup. Sushi-grade tuna. Shaved rare roast beef. Beets. If it's not red, Jacob will get very agitated. And sometimes he'll go to his room and stop speaking to us. There's a color for each day of the week, for food and for clothing. In his closet, his clothes hang in rainbow order, and the different colors aren't allowed to touch.
She turns to the jury, as we've practiced.
Jacob craves routine. He gets up at 6:20 every morning, whether it's a school day or a weekend, and he knows exactly what time he has to leave for school and when he'll get back home. He never misses an episode of Crime Busters, which is on the USA Network at 4:30 every day of the week. He writes notes in his journals while he's watching, even though in some cases he's seen the episode a dozen times. He always puts his toothbrush on the left side of the sink when he's done using it, and he sits behind the driver in the back seat of the car, even when he's the only other passenger.
What happens when Jacob's routine is disrupted?
It's very upsetting for him,
Emma says.
Can you explain?
When he was little, he'd scream or throw a tantrum. Now he's more likely to withdraw. The best way I can explain it is that you'll be looking right at Jacob, and he's not with you.
You have another son, don't you?
Yes. Theo is 15.
Does Theo have Asperger's?
No.
Are Theo's clothes arranged in rainbow order?
She shakes her head.
Most of the time they're in a heap on his floor. Does he eat only red food on Tuesdays? He eats anything that's not nailed down, Emma says, and some of the women on the jury laugh. Are there times that Theo doesn't feel like talking to you? Absolutely. He's a very ordinary teenager. Is there a difference between Theo withdrawing and Jacob withdrawing? Yes, Emma says. When Theo doesn't communicate with me, it's because he doesn't want to. When Jacob doesn't communicate with me, it's because he can't. Did you take steps to help Jacob adapt better to social situations? Yes, Emma says. She pauses, clears her throat. I hired a private tutor to help him practice those skills. Jess Ogilvie. Did Jacob like Jess? Emma's eyes fill with tears. Yes. How do you know? He was comfortable with her. And there aren't many people he's comfortable with. She got him to do things that he wouldn't normally. Emma breaks off and buries her face in her hands. What the fuck? Ms. Hunt, I say. Thank you. Nothing for... Wait. She interrupts. I'm not finished. This is news to me. I shake my head just the tiniest bit, but Emma is staring at Jacob. I wanted to say... She turns to the jury. Jacob told me he didn't want her to die, that it wasn't his fault. My eyes widen. This is unscripted territory, dangerous ground. Objection, I blurt out. Hearsay. You can't object to your own witness, Helen says, delighted. But I don't have to give my own witness enough rope to hang herself either, and the rest of us as well. Then I'm finished, I say, sitting down beside Jacob, suddenly afraid that I'm not the only one.
Jacob. She told them. My mother told them the truth. I look at the jury, at each of their expectant faces, because now they must know I'm not the monster that all these other witnesses have made me out to be. Oliver cut my mother off before she could say the rest, but surely they understand. Before we begin the cross-examination, counselors, the judge says, I'd like to make up some of the ground we lost yesterday with an early dismissal. Do either of you object to finishing out this witness's testimony before we adjourn for the day? That's when I look at the clock and see that it's 4:00. We're supposed to leave now, so I can be home in time for Crime Busters at 4:30. Oliver, I whisper, say no. There is no way I'm leaving your mother's last words in the jury's minds all weekend long, Oliver hisses back at me. I don't care how you deal with it, Jacob, but you're going to deal with it. Mr. Bond, the judge says, would you care to let us in on your conversation? My client was just letting me know the delay in adjournment is agreeable to him. I'm tickled pink, Judge Cuttings says, although he doesn't look tickled or pink. Ms. Sharp, your witness. The prosecutor stands up. Ms. Hunt, where was your son on the afternoon of January 12th? He went to Jess's house for his lesson. What was he like when he came home? She hesitates. Agitated. How did you know? He ran up to his room and hid in the closet. Did he exhibit any self-destructive behaviors? Yes, my mother says. He hit his head against the wall repeatedly. It's interesting for me to hear this. When I have a meltdown, I don't remember the meltdown very well. But you were able to calm him down, weren't you? Eventually. What techniques did you use? The prosecutor asks. I turned off the lights and put on a song that he likes. Was it Bob Marley's I Shot the Sheriff? Yes. It's 4:07, and I'm sweating. A lot. He uses a song called I Shot the Sheriff as a calming technique? Helen Sharp asks. It has nothing to do with the actual song. It happened to be a melody he liked, and it would soothe him when he was having a tantrum when he was little. It just stuck. It certainly ties into his obsession with violent crime, doesn't it? I'm not obsessed with violent crime. I'm obsessed with solving it. Jacob's not violent, my mother says. No? He's on trial for murder, Helen Sharp replies. And last year he assaulted a girl, didn't he? He was provoked. Ms. Hunt, I have here the report of the school resource officer who was called in after that incident. She gets it stamped as evidence. Now it's 4:00.